very grateful to you for having me. And yeah, this talk is called Earworms. Hopefully we have sound a little bit. Okay. So today, I'm going to try to persuade you that musical sounds are independent beings in their own right. Just like worms, in fact. I'm going to use the example of the earworm to demonstrate this. And when I'm doing this, it will become clear that the differences between sound, noise, and music, the differences between foreground and background, and the differences between a single thing and a group of things, a tune and a city, part of a city and another part of a city, and so on, these differences do not evaporate into nothing, nothing at all, but they become weird. That is to say, they cease to be thin, rigid, and metaphysical. So do the differences between listening, playing, hearing, and composing, between tunes and tuning. So we've all heard earworms, those irritating tunes or parts of tune that seem to live rent-free in our heads. Why do they do that? Answering that it's because they are so compelling begs the question. I wrote some sentences here which I forgot to read, so I'm now going to rotate my talk by 90 degrees and read those sentences. And likewise, the differences between being active and passive, between being a person and being a thing, between life and non-life, will also start to become weird. Yeah, and I hope to show you why Felicity Ford was right to say thanks to Brussels for all the sounds on the first evening. So, earworms. In this talk, I'm going to explore the strange, loopy, logical structure of earworms and explain why it's better not to get rid of them, but rather to coexist with them and possibly embrace them. A sentence has its own logical DNA and is mind-independent. It is a kind of entity, an object, in the terminology used by object-oriented ontology. Likewise, a sentence has its own grammatical, syntactical, and sonic genome. In this sense, a sentence is like a virus. Viruses are chronologically subsequent to bacteria in evolutionary time, but they are logically prior, since they encapsulate the strange loop that exists between a physical system and a semiotic one. In the same way, what is called a riff, sruti, lick, chop, has its own logical, semiotic, and physical DNA. A sound, considered in this sense, is like a virus, which is why the term earworm is highly appropriate. We can think of ideas themselves as viral structures for which minds are vectors. In the same way, earworms are spread by humans and other related vectors, such as MP3 players. Riffs are logically prior to the tunes and so on in which they find themselves. This means that distinctions such as natural, unnatural, sound, noise, and so on fail when subjected to enough analytical or musical pressure. This failure is not due to the fuzziness of human perception or subjectivity or the context in which sounds appear. This failure has to do with the deep ontological structure of entities as such. They are riven from within between what they are and how they appear, even to themselves. It's better to think sounds as entities in their own right, coexisting in an ecology of sonic hosts and parasites in which the host-parasite distinction is neither thin nor rigid. Entities that in some strong sense display something like agency and something like affect, earworms. My talk examines the implications of thinking in this way. Ambient phenomena are an ideal way to probe this thought. First then, let's examine the loop quality of the sonic entities that I now start to call earworms. A sound is a physical entity, yet it is also an aesthetic appearance. Naturally, the aesthetic appearance of a sound can also act as a carrier wave for semiotic signals. But even without an explicit meaning or semiotic quality, a sound is internally riven. That is to say, a sound is split between its essence and its appearance, what it is and how it appears. There is a certain sound wave of a certain frequency To me, a human being sitting in a Boeing 777 at 39,000 feet, it sounds like the deep roar of an engine. How can I know that there is a gap between existing and appearing? I can, for instance, note the difference between counting and number. Counting is something that appears. I can show you counting on my fingers, 1, 2, 3. But when you ask me to show you number, I can't do it. All I can do is resort to counting again, pointing to fingers that represent numbers. Yet counting depends on number. There is a gap between number, the essence, as it were, and counting, the appearance. How perfect that the esoteric Buddhist analogy for emptiness, the lack of inherent identity out of which everything arises, is sound. Where does a sound start? Where does it stop? Consider a bell. In what part of the bell does the sound inhere? The clapper, the metal cylinder? Where does it start and stop? When I hear a sound, I discover myself in a totally interconnected, entangled interspace, a place that some call the aesthetic dimension. This dimension is strictly where causality lives. I'm very grateful to Gernot Bemer for pointing out something similar regarding Jakob Bemer's interpretation of aesthetics and causality just now. This dimension is strictly where causality lives, and so it is a magical, slightly dangerous, at the best of times, demonic dimension. This is a deep implication of modern, that is to say, post-Humean, which is to say 200 years old, causality theory. Entanglement is a term I'm using because it is evident that sounds tell stories about the physical objects that make them. And there have to be more than one physical object in order for a sound to arise. Consider the most basic sound, a beat. A beat is made when one wave intersects with another wave. Thus, in order for there to be a beat, there must also be one plus n waves occurring. A sound is an elegy to the withdrawal of these one plus n waves, a present absence, the ghost of a thing. There is something intrinsically spectral about sound. And on this view, just one beat is a kind of earworm. It has all the properties we have been examining so far. This means that there is no fundamental atom of sound to which one can reduce anything. A symphony could be an earworm. A small fragment of the symphony's first movement could be an earworm. A chorus in a pop song could be an earworm. A part of that chorus could be an earworm. And I'm sure we have them in our heads all the time. For some reason I have aha right now. Take on me. I don't know why. Thank you for laughing, by the way. It's very good for my ego. Thank you. The actual physicality of the sound as an explicit being with a certain size and shape withdraws from access. Yet I hear this sound, just this actual sound, the roar of this jet engine surrounding me, slightly behind me, as the plane skirts the edge of Newfoundland. The sound as appearance is the uncanny doppelganger of its physical facticity. This is the sound of a jet engine, not the sound of a rubber band going boing, boing, boing. A sound is an isotope of a thing, like it but unlike it, uncanny, familiar yet strange, familiarly strange, strangely familiar. Yet I cannot locate the gap between the essence of the thing and its appearance anywhere at all in my given ontic phenomenal space. Fortunately or unfortunately, things don't come with a little dotted line on them and a little picture of scissors that says cut here. We don't know where to cut to separate the essence of a thing from its appearance. Up until the modern age, which is to say the later 18th century, which is now to say the beginning of the Anthropocene, the moment at which humans, by releasing carbon compounds into the atmosphere in sufficient quantities, become a geophysical force on a planetary scale, up until this contemporary age, the task of philosophy in the West was construed to be locating the dotted line and cutting. But this is strictly impossible. Why? Because wherever I look for the gap between essence and appearance, all I discover are more appearances. The gap is ontological, not ontic, not given. Thus a sound is a strange loop, like a Möbius strip. I'm very happy to be showing for the millionth time this year. My friend Ian Bogost, who makes video games, is a very good cartoonist, and he's made this cute Ouroboros for me, because most Ouroboroses that you find online are rather scary looking. I wanted to have a slightly silly looking one. Perhaps for reasons that will come clear. And it's a little bit exemplifying this idea of a strange loop, okay? A Möbius strip It's a very strange object. You know this kind of strip where you take a strip of paper and you twist it? It has less dimensions than it seems to. Namely, it only has one edge and it only has one side, whereas it appears to have two. A Möbius strip is a non-orientable surface. That means that I cannot locate its front or back, its top or bottom, anywhere. I can't find the twist, where the twist in the strip begins, the famous twist that forces my finger onto the other side of the strip when it traces the strip. The twist is everywhere. There is no dotted line. On the other hand, a sound is a physical thing. A sound is a physical thing. On the other hand, it is a semiotic thing. But we can't locate where the physical stops and the semiotic starts, anywhere on the surface of the sound. A sound is a Möbius strip, a strange twisted loop whose twist is everywhere. A sound is therefore a self-contradictory, weird entity, just like DNA, a physical structure that is also a semiotic one, in the right kind of environment. A sound talks about the physical entities that made the sound, and yet it doesn't talk about them. This is fundamentally because a sound is always a collusion between one plus n things. We don't hear the wind in itself. We hear the wind in the trees. We hear the wind in the doorway. The sound we hear is a story about trees, wind, human ears, distance, this hood I'm wearing over my head, and so on. Consider Air Pressure Fluctuations by Felix Hess. I'm going to play a little bit of this. Oops, sorry. Hess places contact microphones on the window of his New York apartment. Then he hits record. For several weeks, the recording happens. Then he speeds up the sound 360 times. When he does this, the sound of traffic in the street becomes the tinkling of tiny insects. A new sound becomes audible. It is a sound like the hum of a distant lawnmower, a faint yet palpable vibration. It is the sound of the standing wave of air pressure over the Atlantic Ocean. What is being heard here? A sound that is beyond the normal range of human hearing, to be sure, but a sound that is happening, functioning, executing, nevertheless. The vibration of a pressure wave. What is being heard is the functioning of a thing. This functioning is normally impossible to detect. The environment is what we call the functioning of things that are invisible, to the extent that the way they function, their appearance, is so habitual to us as to have disappeared. But this disappearance is only relative to our habitual perception of a thing. Yet, this habit is only covering up the gap between how a thing appears and what it is. When you think about an environment, you are thinking about a host of functions. Things that execute their specific being. A tree rustles, grass waves, buildings echo. To function is constantly to malfunction. And I'm spelling it here mal-function. To malfunction, because of the gap between what a thing is and how it appears. To function is to malfunction, because to function is not to exhaust the gap between phenomenon and thing, but rather for that gap to be in a state of suspension. This state is just like musical suspension, the coexistence of one plus n melodic lines shifting over one another in such a way that they are related yet distinct. They are out of phase with one another, such that, for instance, we hear one changing while the other one appears still. Malfunctioning, a slightly evil functioning, insofar as the aesthetic dimension, which just is the intersection and clash of appearances and appearances, suspended over the deeper clash between appearances and things, is a total dimension from which it is impossible to extricate myself physically, employing a very good acceleration, for instance, or cognitively, employing some concept of meta-language. I find myself among sounds, glued to them. They are viscous. When I pull away, they stick to me. This means that, for instance, the snippets of speech about Tin City that we've been hearing in the documentary Echoes are immediately folded into the sonic space rather than floating above it. We cannot achieve escape velocity. When I say slightly evil, what I don't mean is actually evil. What I mean is that the gap between being and appearing cannot be reduced, so I am left in a realm of ambiguity that much Western philosophy has called evil. In particular, the kind of evil Plato thinks when he thinks about art. Plato sees art as an earworm from some demonic beyond that is causal. It infects your head with all kinds of thoughts. And like dirty candies lying in the street, you don't know where they've been before they ended up in you. Because functioning is malfunctioning, there is no way to achieve what Alvin Lucio says he wants to achieve in I Am Sitting in a Room. The smoothing out of irregularity. Instead, what that piece gives birth to is a demonic realm of appearance that floats ontologically in front of things. A palpable bell-like gauze of rainbow sound wafting like a theatrical curtain. An irreducible viscous medium. A thing with its own gap between being and appearing. Alvin Lucier is so beautifully explicit, so honest about his intentions, about how he wants the piece I Am Sitting in a Room to function. The act of sitting in a room itself is an innocent-seeming functioning of a human body. Yet what he achieves is this incredible sonic gauze, this undulating froth of sound. Sitting in a room is not so innocent. Functioning is malfunctioning. An earworm is a special entity that is part of the general environment, that is, the general atmosphere of malfunctioning that makes up the environment. For some reason, we have become susceptible to this particular entity, just as one might get the flu or not, depending on one's resistance to the flu virus. We notice the environment when it ceases to function smoothly, when we get some kind of flu. An earworm is a strange inside-out reminder that we inhabit a sonic environment. An atmosphere, then, is a nest of worms, a host of malfunctioning entities, tools like an earplug on a special sound walk that lose their functionality, sometimes by being used properly. Even to function on this view is to malfunction. Functioning is a rare form of malfunctioning. Now we are in a position to think about earworms in a precise way. An earworm is a malfunctioning loop that has a specific determinate structure. Such a loop can only exist if it is reproduced, for instance, by a human mind. An earworm has the same form as a virus. A virus is a physical entity that is also semiotic. It is a loop of code, RNA or DNA, that can only exist on the inside of another entity that it is forced to reproduce itself. We are earworm vectors. From a certain point of view, then, a human being is an entity whose task is to reproduce a certain musical phrase by Katy Perry over and over again for no reason. What is susceptibility to earworms? Why do we become earworm vectors? Because earworms want to be reproduced. And this means, in the absence of a metaphysics of consciousness and volition, that the earworm is a strange loop that is inherently unstable, constantly trying to cancel itself out. Consider the liar. The sentence that says, this sentence is false. On the one hand, it is false, it is lying, so it is not false, it is telling the truth. On the other hand, perhaps it is true, in which case it must be false, in which case it is lying. The liar is true and false at the same time. In other words, it is dialetheic, double-truthed. The trouble with double truth is that, as Lacan says, what constitutes pretense is that in the end you don't know whether it's pretense or not. If I could see through the double truth, I could reduce it to one. A thing is a liar in this sense, because its appearance tells the truth about it, but its appearance is not it, so its appearance is lying. And yet we can't check in advance to find out where the truth stops and the lie starts. We can only impose our will on appearing in hindsight, backwards. A profound ambiguity lies at the heart of appearing, which is to say how causality functions, which is to say how a bell sounds when it is struck. A sound is a ghost that haunts us. It haunts us precisely because it presents us with a riddle that begs to be solved, the riddle of the gap between being and appearing, but which cannot be solved. It is thus a futural riddle. It might be solved, or not, at some point. This possibility floats on top of a deep insolubility, in the same way that the predictable future floats on top of a radically unpredictable one, a futurality rather than some now point that is X now points away from the one that we call the present. In this regard, a sound is the past, insofar as it is a story about two or more things that made it. The wind brushed against the leaves just so, listen. On the other hand, a sound is the future, insofar as it opens up this region of wanting to be solved. A sound is not the present. If we think of the present as a definable atom of any size, 1 nanosecond, 1 century, 1 million years, what sounds evoke, rather, is nowness, a shifting relative motion between past and future. This is what it means to think sound without the metaphysics of presence, which, for reasons I shall give soon, is the right way to think sound. When we try to peel appearing away from being, we cannot do it, because there is no pre-given, obvious dotted line between being and appearing, and nothing like a pair of scissors in sight. So in trying to peel appearing away from being, we ironically create all kinds of appearances. Consider again DNA. It is trying to unzip itself, to resolve its inner instability. Yet when it does so, it ironically ends up reproducing itself. The very act of trying to die is also an act of reincarnation. An earworm has its own logical DNA. It has a structure that is independent of the mind that is its vector. How can I know this? We can know it because logical statements of any kind are mind independent. If they were not, then we would be stuck in an infinite regress. If logical statements were only brain firings, then that statement would also be a brain firing, and we could never check its veracity. An earworm lives in your brain. You are its vector. We live in a symbiotic ecology. A fungus growing in a certain caterpillar forces the caterpillar to climb up the tree, where it will burst and allow the fungal spores to be released to maximum effect. Toxoplasma gondii is another kind of worm, an amoeba that lives in your head. This amoeba tunes you to cats. You try to seek them out, because cats are the main vectors for this amoeba. Roughly 40% of us have this amoeba. It is possible that a neurotoxin released in some people's brains by this amoeba could be the cause of schizophrenia. An earworm is just like that, in a sense. You become susceptible to it. You allow it to live in your head, even when you don't consciously like it. This couldn't happen unless earworms were profoundly independent, independent beings, in the same way that amoebae and viruses are independent beings. It is only that viruses, like earworms, need another entity to enable them to reproduce. They are parasites, but at a certain resolution, the distinction between host and parasite breaks down, because of course there's also viral DNA in your DNA, and so on and so on. And who's running the show? Reverse engineering from this thought about neurotoxins and symbionts that live in your head, I wonder whether earworms are like hallucinations. A kind of proto-thought. It's quite possible that thinking as such is an emergent property of the kinds of hallucination we have learned to have by co-evolving with plants and mushrooms, as some ethnobotany is now beginning to explore. Perhaps this is why earworms are so compelling. Why indeed we write music that contains them? Because they are like human-made models of the kind of symbiotic entity that arose from other forms of symbiosis, namely thoughts that arose from hallucinations, that arose from plants. Isn't a hallucination a compelling, earworm-like thought that grows like a plant without your will? Isn't that what is either wonderful or disturbing about it? A hallucination, a thought, a flower, is an earworm, a virus. None of these can exist without something else. But then, in a way, viruses and thoughts and flowers are the logical precursors of the physical things that have them. Brains and bacteria and plants, for instance. Brains and bacteria are the chronological precursors of viruses and thoughts. Bacteria came before viruses chronologically. But logically, viruses come before bacteria. They are, as it were, the condition of possibility for life forms. Non-living strands of code, foreign intelligences, as Schopenhauer put it, that force other strands of code to go into a loop. Because isn't this what being a strand of code in a physical format means in the first place? DNA, again, is an inconsistent molecule that is trying to unzip itself into non-existence. In the very attempt to cease, it ironically reproduces itself, since, as Schopenhauer and his follower Freud argued, the purpose of life is death. But in following that purpose, you make more of yourself and continue life. I see a deep similarity between a flower and an earworm. We could call both tropes. That is why an anthology is a collection of poems, because anthos means flower in Greek. In the same way as hallucinations underlie thoughts, tropes underlie meaning, which is weird, because a trope is a kind of meaning. A hallucination is a kind of thought. We seem to be in a loop, the kind of strange loop I have been discussing, where there is a twist between physicality and significance that you can't locate anywhere on the surface of the loop. A trope appears only to be a flower of rhetoric, as they say. They always talk in English about flowery language, right? Whereas it is, in fact, its logical precondition. This is because rhetoric is about making people susceptible to arguments, which is why it is really based not on words per se, but on listening. Which is why section 2 of Aristotle's Rhetoric is a very beautiful, comprehensive account of different kinds of affect. The affective environment is the susceptibility of the audience, and the job of the orator is to work directly on that susceptibility to give them some kind of flu. There is no such thing as a totally empty, neutral, or silent space. Silence in rhetoric simply means listening, which means susceptibility, and in the end, music is a special kind of listening in itself, or as Miles Davis said, or rather as a rhetorical earworm often attributed to Miles Davis says, you have to play a long time to sound like yourself. The useless beauty of a flower or an earworm is thus not a cynical ruse to make more earworms. It is just a kind of viral code that serves no purpose, but which, when caught in another system, say a bee's search for nectar, ends up ironically reproducing itself. Thus, viruses, flowers, iridescent wings, Kantian beauty, tropes, earworms, and daft ideas that float around in my head all share something. They are symptoms of an irreducible gap between being and appearance that eats away at the metaphysics of presence from the inside, eats away like a parasite in a host at the idea of being as a stable, homogeneous chunk beneath appearances, whether we think that with Plato, Aristotle, or with contemporary atomists and reductionist materialists. And here I am arguing that not only might viruses and tropes and earworms share something, some kind of family resemblance, they might actually be part of the same physical family. So that when I hear an earworm, I really am hearing a trope. And when I use a trope, I really am reproducing a virus. And when I get a virus, I am flowering. Don't forget that an old definition of parasite concerns not animals, but actually plants. And that plants require parasites, or as Schopenhauer says, the foreign intelligent individual to reproduce. It is like that poem by William Blake, The Sick Rose. It nicely, for us, combines the themes of flower and worm in a single image. O rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night, in the howling storm, has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. Significantly, the worm flies through a sonic welter, a howling storm, a generalized environment of malfunctioning. Slightly evil, at least seemingly, because it just functions, executing its storminess without rhyme or reason. But thinking the storm as really evil, or the worm as Satan, would be going too far. The poem seems to want to dare us to do that. But Blake poems are like earworms, or thoughts in search of a suitable mind. The suitable mind in this case speaks a lie in the form of the truth, which is the case with all Blake's songs of experience. Shock horror. Life involves sex and death, and it's difficult to tell these apart. Life must therefore be, I'm ventriloquizing here, I don't really think this. Life must therefore be intrinsically evil and corrupt, and I, the one who thinks this, am pure, at least in my thinking that thought. Pure me over here, evil life over there. This attitude, pure me, evil world, is what Hegel calls the beautiful soul, and it exemplifies evil. The attitude that sees evil as a thing over yonder, like Al-Qaeda, right? In America good, Al-Qaeda bad. Al-Qaeda's also thinking this, right? Al-Qaeda good, America bad. The attitude that sees evil as this thing over yonder that I can somehow eradicate, this attitude itself is evil. Against the cynical reason in the poem, which Blake appears to be satirizing by turning it into a cartoon of itself, we could assert that the rose couldn't be what it is unless this twisted worm, invisible because we can't directly see it but can only infer it by its results, could be its parasitic symbiont. The rose is susceptible. Which brings me to my final argument. To exist is to be susceptible to the kind of destruction that the worm causes the rose. Why? Precisely because to exist is already to not quite be yourself. To be caught in a loop between what you are and how you appear. To exist is to be fragile, whether you are a rose, a worm, Nelson Mandela, or a black hole. Even a black hole eventually evaporates because it emits Hawking radiation. Nothing can escape from a black hole except for the black hole itself. Even the densest object in the universe is fragile. Another way of saying this is that for every logical system, there must at least be one sentence that the system can create that the system can't prove, in order for that system to be true on its own terms. This is what Gödel did to Russell and Whitehead, which in a way is what earworms do to my head, or what invisible worms do to roses. Even the most rigorous logical system must be able to produce sentences that say this sentence cannot be proved, precisely because of their rigor, not in spite of it. A logical system must be capable of making strange loops, just as RNA is capable of creating viruses, or music is capable of creating earworms. I'm sorry to break it to you, because we are also fragile entities. We can accommodate things that are inconsistent with our being on all kinds of levels. Viruses, cancer, earworms, and Justin Bieber. The normative distinction between high critical art and kitsch thus breaks down. Every sound is an earworm. So the difference between the most unpalatable, to some people, sound art and the most disturbingly palatable, Katy Perry, collapses. We had better not keep insisting then that we are making sounds that are all that different from Katy Perry. This business of making that distinction is sometimes called modernity. In modernity, high art tries not to be an earworm. But since this is strictly impossible, we are left with an impoverished sonic weapon against the perceived problem, namely the commodification of everything. The commodification of everything is not the problem. The problem is the metaphysics of presence. The notion of commodification as such relies on this metaphysics, the idea that underlying an appearance is some deeper, more real, more substantial entity. The idea that we can subtract appearance and get that entity, and that such an entity consists in constant presence despite appearances, and that philosophy consists in finding the dotted line between being and appearance and the right kind of scissors. The difference between high critical art and kitsch might then be a difference not in quality but of quantity. More or less earworms, more or less susceptibility to earworms, more or less earworm virulence. The idea that critical music is to be valued because it is hard to follow or remember has as its logical shadow the idea that kitsch is bad because it is easy to follow and remember, because it has already stuck in your head, because it is a successful earworm. On this view, critical music can only produce more or less impotent earworms. As with spinach, or the idea of worthy or good art in general, impotent earworm production is focused on collapsing a rift that cannot be collapsed, the rift between existing and appearing, which constitutes the semiotic physical loop of an earworm. Thus, a striving towards non-existent nature happens in the most supposedly anti-natural critical high art. This striving cannot be completed for reasons that I just gave, and it only reproduces an idea virus all of its own, the metaphysics of presence. Such a striving seeks impossibly to resolve an implicit contradiction at the heart of what it means to be a thing. Since, as outlined via Gödel, reduced susceptibility to earworms is only ever temporary, it would be better to concentrate one's attention on making more potent earworms. Earworms that could eat Justin Bieber, for instance. We might consider this very brief musical example, only because I like it. What is happening here? The music is building a compelling earworm. To which I am particularly susceptible. It's doing this by employing tritonality. Three different key signatures at once. Sadly, there's not probably enough time to show you that entire phenomenon. It is doing this by employing tritonality. It accommodates inconsistency and contradiction then, while maintaining its rigorous, tight structure. It seems to have been made by layering a number of worm-like sonic entities on top of one another, as the orb says. Because of the tritonality, these weird worms seem to float side by side rather than being totally blended. The spectral weirdness of the aesthetic dimension, the fact that it floats ontologically in front of things, thus comes into focus. Rather than trying to get rid of its worm-like nature, such music revels in it. It just tries to be more compelling than Justin Bieber, to affect our susceptibility to a greater extent, which is to say, to work with our fragility, which is in turn to say, to exploit the invisible gap that worms within us between what we are and how we appear. While capitalism itself is held to have undermined the much of the metaphysics of presence, go away, go away, go away. Thank you. While capitalism itself is often held to have undermined much of the metaphysics of presence, the form this undermining takes leaves a striking part of that metaphysics intact. The form is demystification. High critical art shares with capitalism this demystifying urge. All that is solid melts into air. What they have in common is demystification, which just is the elimination of contradictions, most deeply at the level of being versus appearing. The eliminative strategy actually preserves the metaphysics of presence by positing a real, however transcendental, thing beneath or behind appearances, a real that is more constantly present than appearance, a subtractive real. The ideological mode of demystification is called cynical reason. But the persistence of earworms force us to question cynical reason. Earworms, however, are about susceptibility, which is about what one could call ingenuousness or sincerity. Sincerity means not that you must have a straight face all the time and never laugh. Sincerity means that you are always shrink-wrapped in your phenomena. You cannot achieve escape velocity from them, because when you try, there you are doing that. Or in the words of the great phenomenologist Buckaroo Banzai, wherever you go, there you are. Cynical reason thinks that it can achieve escape velocity from sincerity, but this is strictly impossible because a thought requires a mind, and so on. There are intractable symbioses involved in existing and thinking. The point, then, is not to try and inevitably fail to achieve escape velocity from things. The point would be to try to create earworms that we can live with. The point would be to examine the earworms we already have, and if we don't like them, try to create some kind of allergy medicine for tolerating them. Philosophy should get out of the metaphysical boundary policing business and into the allergy business, allergy medicine business, if it is going to carry on in an ecological age. An earworm is a profoundly environmental entity because it is a physical being that is also a story about one plus n other physical beings. Thoughts, minds, earworms, ears, and worms coexist in an aesthetic causal configuration space. Ecology, which just is post-modernity, not post-modernity, but post-modernity, what comes after modernity, ecology means preserving as many entities and relationships as possible. And this means preserving as many gaps between being and appearing as possible. This means, in turn, attuning ourselves to the difference between what things are and how they appear, which, when we do it, is not just in thought, but in physical practice, amounts to preserving the beings that currently exist on Earth. The job of philosophy in all this is to make us susceptible to susceptibility, which is the ability to tune. We can become more and more susceptible. This is what it would mean to build a tuned city. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the invitation to get infected, but also potentially a medical reason not to listen to AHA. I just hope pharmaceutical companies that have not been listening to this lecture, if they're going to be taking over the music business. We have some time for questions, and there's lunch after that, so if there's anything that has come up.
First, thanks very much for the lecture.
My pleasure.
Well, I don't know if I still have a question, so I'm just landing.
I don't know if I have an answer for the same reason.
It's probably, I'm not sure, often a problem or just trying to pose some mind in the process that you were going through the lecture. More or less at the beginning, you very interestingly identify the earworm with not only what we usually think of kind of segment of sound, for example, or you were choosing to do symphonies or movements or whatever. When you show the example of Felix Hess, potentially following your first criteria, that could be also an earworm,
yes,
or could be related to an earworm. My question is, for example, if you have played that segment without telling us the origin of it, without telling us that it was this compression or 360, etc., we would have probably each one differently, but we would probably identify it or apprehend it following different memories or references that we have. And we would have probably not said that it was that, but we would identify it as a kind of particular kind of sound, particular electric qualities that would identify with some medium, some kind of synthesis, or we would, there would be some question about how to relate, for example, to the turbine recordings from ESA, for example. So in the experience of timbre, which would be that experience, which is not probably the symphony example, we would be embedding something of our own preferences. So something that we would probably relate to the area of the subjective, to the construction of the subject. But all your development has to do with breaking up this subject, which is actually built on this relationship between ethics and appearance, rather than...
You're doing so beautifully, so much better than I could do this question. Thank you.
So my question would be, well, from that, how we can think about this timbre or subject issue?
Yes, this was very much a similar question as the first question that was given to Professor Birma, I feel, which is the question of anthropomorphism and anthropocentrism. Okay. Now, as somebody who does ecological philosophy, I think the enemy there is anthropocentrism. The enemy is not anthropomorphism. Why? Because according to my argument, I can't help anthropomorphizing that sound. In other words, not just conceptually, right, but with my ears and with my body, I anthropomorphize it in this kind of expanded sense, right? Since I can't help doing that, in a way, there's less of a problem. But there's even less of a problem when I realize that, for example, a virus, when it infects me, is virus pomorphizing me, right? The cup, when I pick up the cup, is cup pomorphizing my fingers. It's, in a way, the cup wants to be held just this way, right? When I pick up a hammer, it asks me a little bit to hold it in a certain way, right? So non-human entities also do this pomorphization, right? Non-human entities also have agency. Non-human entities also therefore have, you know, and unfortunately Christoph is not here, he will disagree with me, but they dream, right? They fantasize, they dream, they have imagination, unquote, right? Whatever that is. And yes, I am a little bit here a panpsychist, actually. But that doesn't mean that I think everything is really special and complicated. What I think is that mind is actually a very, very simple thing, much more simple than we like to think, right? Mind is, when I put my mind on this glass, it's very much similar to what the glass is doing when it's resting on the table. It's incredibly simple. It's just a physical relationship that emerges as an aesthetic one. Right, so we've been looking for mind in the wrong places. All we've been looking at it as this amazing bonus prize for being highly evolved, which is not very a Darwinian concept, actually. It's not a bonus prize for being highly evolved. There is no high evolved, you know. Thank you again for the termites, right? There's no high evolution. There's no linear sort of progress, right? So to me, the problem is anthropocentrism. In other words, it's the idea that me alone in all the world, a human being, or possibly a Western human being, or a white human being, or whatever, has some special privileged access to things, right? Instead, what I'm trying to argue is that everything, cups, viruses, me, my hair, bits of me, parts of me, you know, all apprehend other things and themselves in this way that never quite coincides with them, right? Because as try as it might, the cup's never going to succeed in cup pomorphizing me perfectly, right? Try as I might, I'm never going to totally anthropomorphize that Felix Hess, right? And in the same way, the Felix Hess, the music, is the sound, is sound pomorphizing me, right? So the problem is not so much me feeling things and thinking things, right? The problem is me thinking that me, a human being, is the only special entity in the whole of reality that does that, which is the problem we've had since Kant, right? Kant opens up this gap between being and appearing, and almost immediately, I think he unconsciously thinks, oh my God, what did I just do? I opened up Pandora's box, which is the nothingness box, which we can talk about if you like. How do I put it back in the box? I have to say, police it, right? So there's only one special gap in the world, right, according to Kant, right? It's the gap, also Heidegger, it's the gap between human being, Dasein, or reason, whatever, and everything else, right? But for me, there are gaps everywhere. There's the gap between the cup and the table. There's the gap between the microphone and the sound going into the microphone. There's the gap between the microphone and the speaker, right? There's the gap between me sitting here and desperately trying to explain something and what I'm actually doing, which is making it worth, and so on, right? So in my universe, reality is like a piece of beautiful Japanese raku-ware pottery, right? It's got thousands of trillions of cracks everywhere, thousands of little tiny micro-transcendences everywhere.
So, I'm just wondering, given the entire logic, how you could advocate finding worthier earworms. Where does the basis of worthiness come from?
That's a thank you for that too. I actually think that, on my view, according to this logic, you can distinguish between worthy and not so worthy, right? I actually think that if everything really is just atoms or just some kind of fudge or just rhizomes or just, you know, the kind of philosophical anxiety, I've got to get it down to nothing but atoms or rhizomes or fudge or some kind of thing, you know, that's underneath what's appearing, then I have no criteria, right? If, on the other hand, I think that there is an intrinsic gap, you know, and the things that appear, things that are basically art, right? And I'm here using art to describe not just what I do or that what you do, but, you know, as the way a piece of paper might slide alongside another piece of paper, right? If there's that gap, then there is such a thing as sort of worthiness, perhaps. Now, we could probably spend the rest of the day or maybe the rest of our life figuring out what that might be, and maybe we would all have different criteria for what that is, right? But I'm going to definitely suggest that from an ontological point of view, yes, there is a way to say Katy Perry earworms are less good than some other earworm, let's say, for example. It's not purely subjective. There are reasons why it's not good. Perhaps one criterion might be, for me, violence. Right? Violence is, for me, when something or somebody tries to reduce the gap between being and appearing. Right? So when I shoot myself, I'm turning myself into your memory of me. All that remains of me are appearances. The gap has disappeared. Right? When something dies, it's because the gap between being and appearing has disappeared. Right? Consider when a sound wave of an appropriate frequency hits a glass. Right? The sound wave successfully glass-pomorphizes the glass in that moment. If you successfully pomorphize, it's called killing or destroying, right? Because the next thing that you see is fragments of glass. You don't see the disappeared, destroyed glass anywhere, just in the same way you never see my death anywhere in phenomenal space. You just see bits of paper in a wastebasket. You just have memories and feelings. I've been reduced to your appearance of me. Right? And so I think that non-violence would be a criterion for whether an earworm is a worthy one or not. Is it trying to get rid of me? You know, is it trying to get rid of other earworms? Right? I think maybe in the world of Katy Perry, there's only two choices, right, in that kind of pop music world, which is a shame, right? When I constrain the choices, that's another kind of violence. The choice is between resisting death, right, or being death, right? And clearly the reason for that kind of, and now I'm going to sound like an old curmudgeon, which I am, you know, the kind of auto-tuned vocoding horror of that kind of music is precisely that the music is being death. It's sort of, in a way, trying to kill you. You know, if you turned up a very harmonious sound, really, really, really loud, it could kill you. I mean, I'm saying this as somebody who's going to see My Bloody Valentine in Denver in a few weeks' time, right? If you turn up that sound loud enough, it makes your ears explode, and you don't want to stop it because it's so beautiful, right? So I think another criterion is that, funnily enough, what we call harmony, what we call beauty, if we're Kantians or whatever, is death, right? And what we call noise, if noise is in a way birth, right? Noise is the beginning of a thing. Right, noise is how something begins. The glass goes crash, and all of a sudden there's all these little tiny bits of glass in my fingers. That's the beginning of something. That's the birth of all these little bits of glass. Existing, on the other hand, living, which is between life and death, would be suspension, right? Like in the sort of disco, right? And the object of coexisting ecologically would be to have as many possible kind of entative plates in the air as possible, all spinning away, all suspended on each other without destroying each other. Right. So I think, I mean, I'm not talking very well here, but that, in a clumsy way, I think that gives us some criteria for worthiness.
Maybe time for one more question. Timothy has to get to a trillion.
I'm afraid I've become reduced only to appearance in about 3 minutes.
I've just become threatened you. If you're comfortable, can I have just one more?
Absolutely.
Short,
of course.
Because one of the things that was striking to me was a term that you used at the beginning, which was the entangled interspace.
Hmm.
When you were talking about earworms. And the thing was that if you're talking about viruses and this two-way street of affordance, it would seem to me that all of those things were located. Whereas when you start to talk about the kind of viruses that you're talking about, it suddenly slips away from us. It's a moment
yes.
of grip where you talk about like, the first question in terms of time scales, it's kind of an infinite regressive. You can talk about a single tick as
yes.
a normative kind of worm.
Yes.
So can you,
yes.
can we even ask why is there this discrepancy?
Yes. Thank you. Infinite regress, that's a good phrase. I'm much happier with infinite regresses. Is that right? Infinite regresses, infinite regressions? Than I am with the idea, which is the idea you have to think if you don't feel okay about infinite regress. I think the other possibility is that you know where the dotted line is and you can cut with your scissors, right? In order not to do that, you have to tolerate the possibility that there's an infinite regress of sounds within sounds within sounds within sounds, right? And of things within things within things, right? So there's me, and I have my nose, and my glasses, and I have my legs, right? And these things are different from me, yet they are also me, and there's a kind of infinite regress there. So what we have in reality is a kind of weird, paradoxical set of things. The kind of set of things that Bertrand Russell found very obnoxious about Cantor. We have a set of things that include things that aren't members of that set. But that's also what we have in ecological reality, right? If you think about a meadow or a city, I keep thinking about Matin's incredible performance the other day and about how he was trying to be a city, right? And the interesting thing about trying to be a city is you're trying to be a set of things that include all kinds of things that aren't precisely you, right? There's bridges and tunnels and people and racism and classism and speciesism, let's talk about that, right? And yet they're also the city. And you're not a popsicle, right? Matin wasn't being a popsicle. He was being Stockholm, right? And so a city is a city, not a popsicle. Nevertheless, when I looked for the city, I don't find the essence of the city anywhere in the subway, the airport, the tram, whatever, right? The food, the people. I don't find it. Nevertheless, I'm in a city, right? To exist in this way is to be an inconsistent, fuzzy set that is internally contradictory, right? Now, this is answering one part of your question, I think. The previous part was a little bit about entanglement, and I wonder whether you could ask it again.
Where is the earworm located?
Oh,
can you
right.
ask them with that
question? Right. The trouble is, if I have a concept of location that has to do with pre-packaged space-time, I'm not going to find it. Instead, what I'm going to find are all kinds of paradoxes, Right. It's like being in the middle of Brussels, you know, trying to find where to go in the middle of... Excuse me, I only just arrived, right? But when you get into that medieval space, you suddenly encounter a strange world in which Zeno's paradoxes seem to be given a kind of new lease on life, right? And you go up a little street and you're like, oh, it's not there. And your anxiety increases, especially if you have a wife and kids. You're trying to find them after you've been to this conference called Toon City Brussels. Have you heard of it? And you get back, you're trying to find your family and you can't find them, but they're actually about 2 feet away, right? This is because you have a rigid, you know, concept of time and space going on, right? If you have that, then you can't find it, right? Because from this point of view, you think the future is something that happens, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, some specifiable amount of time away from now, right? What I'm saying instead is that if objects, that is, not objectified things, but, you know, just everything, things, entities, are not metaphysically present, right? If they're not solid and kind of blair and kind of boring cupcakes of blair decorated with candy sprinkles of appearance, which is kind of what we think they are, that's the kind of default Aristotelianism that we still have in our head. If we don't think that, then we have already dropped the idea of present in some way. And that's what happens, actually, when you meditate, to me. You know, and I think a sound conference is a very useful place for assessing this idea, that actually, when you drop the idea of present, it's not like there's this total void. There's not absolutely nothing at all. There is instead a kind of weird, shimmering, flickering nothingness that is like the relative motion of two trains, right? A thing, on this view, is like a train station. Yeah, can you tell I'm anxious to get to the train? The thing is like a train station, and the past is one train, and the future is another train, and they're sliding over each other like this. You don't know which carriage you're in, right? But the relative motion, right, is what I'm calling nowness, right? Now, you can specify present to mean a certain size of atom, but it doesn't correspond to reality. What to me corresponds to reality is that in order to be a glass, this thing has to be a train station, where past and future are sliding past each other, right? In other words, time is not something that things sit in, right? Time, as we know from Einstein, is a kind of liquid that pours out of things, rippling, right? And this thing times me and itself and the desk, and I time it. It also spaces me. Time and space are things that things do, right? Because on this view, which actually just is a weird, trippy version of Hume, funnily enough, on this view, which is also just scientific causality theory, on this view, cause and effect are actually part of the aesthetic dimension.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We're going to wrap up go over to lunch that's going to be presented in the building next door. I would just urge you to be back before 2 o'clock. We're going to start at 2 o'clock with the last lecture for the symposium sessions. So, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Screwed in.
Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's incredibly difficult.
Oh, it's a gift. So touched by that.
Not with their machine design.